The third case for oral argument this morning is, we'll just call him Dakota Systems and others, versus Gary Viken, who's the South Dakota Department of, Secretary of the South Dakota Department of Revenue and Regulation. For the appellants, would be Dennis Duncan, an attorney from Parker, and Mr. Robert Ernst, is that correct, sir?
Correct.
From Chicago. And my understanding is that you'll be doing the presentation, Mr. Ernst?
That's right.
All right, well, welcome to South Dakota. And for the Department of Revenue, we have Mr. David D. Least, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierce. You may proceed, Mr. Ernst, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, this appeal concerns Chapter 1033A. And we submit that Chapter 1033A is preempted because it explicitly regulates the entry of wireless service providers in this state in violation of Section 332 of the Federal Communications Act. And just as importantly, and just as obviously, Chapter 1033A violates the South Dakota Constitution because it combines three distinct subjects in violation of Article 3, Section 27 of the Constitution. I'd like to begin with the federal preemption argument. And in our view, the federal preemption argument begins, and we would submit ends, with Section 332C3A of the Communications Act. Now, the language of that statute is direct and absolute, and it provides in relevant part that no state shall have any authority, uses the word any authority to regulate the entry of wireless service. Well, that's exactly what Chapter 1033A does right on its face.
But doesn't all taxing, I mean, if we're to adopt your argument, it seems to me that we would have to say that any taxing scheme is regulation of entry.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think there's a very fundamental difference between 1033A, which right on its face regulates entry, versus other taxing schemes which do not on their face regulate entry. For example, we raised the example in our briefs of the North Dakota gross receipts statute, gross receipts tax statute. Unlike the South Dakota statute, the North Dakota statute does not have a licensing provision, therefore, of course, does not impose criminal penalties for any violation of the licensing provision, doesn't have any pre-entry bonding requirement.
Are you saying then that all taxes by the state of South Dakota are preempted, or simply the manner in which they did it here?
It is absolutely the latter, Your Honor. And just to remove any doubt, we do not claim that all state taxes are preempted. To the contrary, we already pay without objection a sales tax in this state. We pay a property tax without objection in this state. Our objection is far more focused and far more limited. And what we say is that when a statute like 1033A explicitly and on its face regulates entry of wireless carriers, then and only then does it violate Section 332. Let me review with the court just a few of the critical provisions of Chapter 1033A. First of all, it imposes a license requirement on any provider that wishes to do business in this state. It gives the Secretary of Taxation discretion to impose licensing regulations. It specifically requires the revocation of a license to any taxpayer that fails to comply with the tax scheme. It permits denial of a license to a taxpayer delinquent in the payment of any South Dakota taxes. It imposes criminal penalties on a failure to comply with the licensing scheme.
How does that affect entry into the market?
It absolutely...
I understand the licensing part because they need that before, but there really isn't much to the licensing other than providing their name and address and things of that nature. It isn't discretionary with the Department of Revenue.
I agree with that, Your Honor, but Section 332 is absolute on its face. It says no state shall have any authority to regulate entry.
Okay, therefore, how do these other things regulate entry?
Well, the provisions, it's not all provisions of the statute, and I certainly grant you that. The provisions we object to are those provisions that really relate to licensing, and I've tried to enumerate them here. It is several of the provisions. For example, a pre-entry bonding requirement really does regulate entry. Now, but just to continue to address Your Honor's question, it doesn't matter whether a license application is, for example, one page, as it concededly is here, or whether it's 50 pages. The whole point of Section 332, as we explain in our moving brief, is to free wireless carriers from state-by-state entry requirements. When Congress enacted Section 332 in 1993, it recognized that this service is inherently interstate. It wanted carriers to build national networks without having to be concerned without satisfying individual state entry requirements.
Doesn't the state of South Dakota have some right to ascertain who's doing business in its state?
It absolutely does, Your Honor. But again, it can do that without affecting entry. For example, to pick up on one of the earlier questions, the state of South Dakota, just as, and this is just one example, the state of North Dakota can impose a tax. It can require a taxpayer to get a tax ID number. If a taxpayer is delinquent, it can use a normal lien and levy process to collect its taxes. We're not suggesting that the state be unable to tax. We're not suggesting that the state be unable to effectively administer and collect its taxes. Again, what we're suggesting is it cannot, in effect, put a stop sign up at the state and say you can't enter without a license, without satisfying certain requirements. Just to take a step back, the way I look at these provisions is if the State Public Utility Commission one day said, we're going to impose a licensing requirement, we're going to impose a pre-entry bonding requirement, we're going to attach certain sanctions to a failure to comply with those provisions, I think that would there would be much less doubt about whether that violates Section 330A as entry regulation. I submit that that's exactly what the state's done here, except it's taken those regulatory provisions and grafted them on to a tax provision. And that fact cannot change the analysis under Section 332.
Well, if you look at the enforcement mechanisms that the Congress has granted to the Internal Revenue Service, what the Department of Revenue seems to have here is tame, and yet the purpose of Internal Revenue seems to be to tax, not to regulate.
I think, again, Your Honor, I'm not sure what the purpose of these provisions were. I'm not sure what the legislature had in its mind, but I am very certain of what the effect is on their face, which is to set an entry regulation requirement. And again, the language of 332 is very absolute on its face. It says the state shall not have any authority to regulate entry. And there's a very fundamental difference between provisions that do it on their face and other sorts of provisions that, sure, down the road, could a lot of things affect a wireless carrier's ability to do business in the state? Sure. Wireless carriers, for example, are subject to the state's normal fraud and consumer deception laws. Hypothetically, the Attorney General's office could bring a fraud action which would shut down a carrier and, and in effect make it unable to do business in the state.
Since you're arguing there's not much that they can do on the front end except implement a tax, on the back end, how can they enforce the tax without crossing the line into regulation?
In exactly, for example, the way that North Dakota does it. The North Dakota statute, on the one hand, permits the state to impose a gross receipts tax, but again, it doesn't have a licensing requirement, doesn't have criminal penalties attached to the licensing requirement, doesn't permit or require the posting of a bond. What it does do is say, if a taxpayer doesn't pay their taxes, the state can have a lien against the taxpayer's property. The state can levy against the taxpayer's property. And that way, the North Dakota statute, and it's just one example, balances, on the one hand, the state's very real and legitimate interest in taxation and tax enforcement, but on the other hand, the very real interest in permitting wireless carriers to enter a state without having to satisfy a very specific licensing requirement. It really was the whole purpose of Section 332 to eliminate these licensing requirements, let carriers enter those markets, and then, again, if a carrier should fail to comply with normal taxation law, normal deceptive practices law, the state is, of course, free to take action. On the point of whether these licensing provisions are necessary, because that really is so much of the state's argument, that without these licensing provisions, the tax can't survive. But we submit there's absolutely no evidence, none at all, no evidence in the record on this summary judgment motion by the state to support that view. It's really just an ipsedixit by the state that it repeats again and again, but with no evidence. Second, as I've already indicated, the whole necessity argument is belied by the fact that North Dakota, again as an example, has a state that functions without the pre-entry licensing requirements. There's another argument that the state raises that I'd also like to address, which is sort of its Trojan horse argument, that if the court were to rule for Verizon Wireless in this case, the next tax to fall will be the sales tax. In fact, there's a very critical difference between this gross receipts tax and 1033A and the sales tax. Excuse me. This gross receipts tax applies only to the sale of service, and it's that sale of service that Section 332 of the Communications Act is fundamentally concerned with. On the other hand, the sales tax applies both to the sale of service, but also to the sale of products like handsets and headsets. Well, Verizon Wireless sells products in this state. It therefore already needs to get a sales tax license to sell those products. As a result, there's no incremental burden placed on Verizon Wireless's sale of service. We already have to comply with the licensing requirements to sell products. So when the state argues that if the court rules for Verizon Wireless here, the sales tax is next, that argument has a fundamental legal problem with it, we'd submit.
Are the sanctions for the gross receipts tax any more burdensome than the sales tax sanctions?
As the state, they are not identical, but I'd say that they are similar in nature, and the state spends a great deal of attention drawing parallels between the two schemes. But for the reasons I explained, as a practical matter, those burden, there's no incremental or additional burden placed on Verizon Wireless's sale of service since we sell products in this state anyway. So right now, today, I have to go, my company has to go get a license to sell products in the state, so it doesn't affect our sale of service at all.
Can you help me with one thing? Could you point to any provision of the state act that is unrelated to the taxation of these gross receipts?
I could point you to subsection 9 of the statute, which is not technically related to gross receipts tax. It permits, I believe, the secretary to deny entry to a carrier that's delinquent in the payment of any South Dakota tax. So technically, it's not specifically related to the payment just of the gross receipts tax. But beyond that, Your Honor, I'd suggest that a relationship test is not the test here. The fact that a provision may be helpful or in some, you know, or in some sense just helpful to the collection of taxes doesn't save it from Section 332. And I return again and again to the very broad, really sweeping preemptive language of Section 332, which denies the state any authority to regulate entry. So, and again, as I also indicated, while these provisions may be helpful, I defy the state to point to any evidence in the record to show that they're really necessary, that they can't have a tax without it. If the court has no further questions at this,
I have a question. How do you then explain the the next phrase, that it doesn't prohibit the state from regulating other terms and conditions of commercial mobile services.
I think if you look at the legislative background to Section 332, and for example, it's discussed in one of the cases that the state relies on, the City of Eugene case, other terms and conditions generally refers to a state's continuing ability, for example, to govern in large part the service provider's relationship with the customer. Service providers remain subject to laws like, for example, consumer protection laws of general application. Those laws that govern terms and conditions of service remain in effect. We concede, of course, that the state's ability to tax remains in effect. But again, several of the provisions of this statute simply pose a barrier to entry. And I'd like to just, even if you look at the, look beyond the substance of what 1033A does, if you look at the specific language it really does use the words of entry regulation. For example, subsection 9 of the statute says that the secretary may require a carrier to post a bond or other security, quote, as a condition precedent to remaining in business as a telecommunications company, end quote. If that's not regulation entry, it's really hard to imagine what would be under the terms of Section 332. With just a few moments left, I'd like to turn briefly to the Article 3, Section 21 argument. The terms or the standard to apply under that constitutional provisions are very familiar to this court. A law may address only one subject, and that subject must be expressed in the title. Here, Chapter 1033A addresses three distinct subjects. It imposes a tax, it makes an appropriation, and it provides entry regulation. First, on the appropriation point, it's very clear that subsections 5 and 6 of the law make an appropriation. That's what the governor found in his veto message. That's what the state appears to concede, at least as to subsection 6 of the statute. That's page 57 of the state's opposition brief. And that's well supported by this court's prior holdings in the APA case and in the Youngquist case as well. Now, once you accept that sections 5 and 6, by establishing a new fund and directing monies to that county telecommunications fund, constitutes an appropriation, the next issue is severance. And we submit that if you strike sections 5 and 6, you cannot sever them from the rest of the statute.
Aren't you impliedly, though, if you say you're going to appropriate money in the title of a bill, doesn't that imply you're going to spend it at some point?
It may, Your Honor, but excuse me.
The purpose, I understand, of that constitutional provision is so we don't sneak in something that is totally foreign to the general purpose of most of the bill. I mean, doesn't it put the public and everybody else on notice that South Dakota is collecting a tax, they're probably going to spend it?
That's correct, Your Honor. But in this, I think this case highlights really one of the purposes of Section 21. The issue of whether those tax proceeds would be directed to the County Telecommunications Fund was really a critical issue. The governor struck those provisions from the statute on the grounds that they constitute an appropriation, and the legislature overrode the veto. So it was a very, very critical issue to know, not just that a tax would be imposed, but where those tax proceeds would ultimately be directed. You know, one of the touchstones of a severance analysis is legislative intent. And often the court is left to really infer legislative intent, sometimes from ambiguous facts. Here, the facts are not ambiguous. The legislature spoke loud and clear about how important it found sections 5 and 6 by overriding Governor Round's veto. And finally, the APA case, among others, says very clearly that where a special fund is created, as it is here in Section 5, that constitutes an appropriation. And of course, an appropriation under this court's South Dakota Educational Association precedent, an appropriation cannot be combined with a bill setting substantive law, as this bill does here. Finally, on one other point, that the statute combines a tax with entry regulation. I don't want to re-review the ways in which the bill constitutes entry regulation, but on the severance point, if the court were to strike those provisions that constitute part of the licensing structure, it would have to strike approximately 50% of the bill, of the statute. It really have to eviscerate the statute. And as the state conceded below, I think it's changed its argument here on appeal, but as the state conceded below, where you strike 50% of the statute really can't function as the legislature intended.
Right, but if only the appropriation part is stricken, that's a much smaller percentage, and why couldn't that be severable?
For the reasons...
Because that requires a higher vote, doesn't it, in order to pass an appropriation act?
It does, Your Honor, but I think the legislature was concerned with at least two things in passing this bill. It wanted to impose the tax, but it very much wanted to then redirect that tax, at least in part, to a county telecommunications fund. If the legislature were unable to redirect the funds to the county telecommunications funds, you simply cannot infer that it nevertheless would have gone ahead and enacted the statute as it was. Again, that's part and parcel of the whole debate between the legislature and the governor.
Justice Zinner, did you have a question?
That was my question. Thank you.
Oh, all right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Weiss, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Mr. Weiss, before you get started, you and I want to make sure I don't miss this. Do you concede for purposes of this case that section, at least section 6 is a special appropriation?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Okay.
Thank you.
Now you can introduce yourself.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. We're here today to determine whether the telecommunication gross receipt tax, a tax in lieu of a property tax, has been preempted by federal law. When we talk about preemption, there are a couple of things we need to keep in mind. Number one, the power to tax is a basic power of the state of South Dakota to exist. When the Congress is going to preempt state taxation, they should do so, therefore, in clear and concise fashion. In this case, we have to focus on the congressional intent. What is the clear and manifest purpose of Congress in Section 332 and 253? What did the Congress intend? That's what drives this case. Do we have direct preemption in these two provisions? No, we don't. They don't say a thing about state taxes being preempted. Congress knows how to do so. They've done so in the airline industry. So then we have what I call indirect preemption. And this is what I mean. Verizon argues that there are 11 provisions that are preempted under 332 and 253. I don't know whether they're giving up their 253 argument or not, but I'm going to continue to address it. These 11 provisions are all typical tax administration statutes. They're in the code for the sole reason to assist in the administration of this tax, to collect the tax. That's the only reason that they are there. Now, Verizon's argument, I think, is one of indirect preemption. Since they couldn't get Congress to directly preempt state taxation, let's have them indirectly preempt state taxation by taking away all of the normal tax administration provisions that I need on behalf of my client to collect this tax.
What about the argument that North Dakota's meets has presented a scheme that is not preempted, and therefore theirs would be valid where South Dakota's would not, because you put too many regulations and criminal sanctions and other things in it? What about that argument?
Well, while North Dakota may have ratcheted back on what they put in their telecommunication tax up there, they have identical provisions in their sales tax, in their income tax, just like we have in our sales tax here in South Dakota, that are being challenged in this case. And furthermore, the argument made by counsel is that, well, North Dakota lets us have a lien on the property of Verizon. Well, here's the problem with that. If I get a lien on Verizon's property and I go to collect on that lien, what happens? I'm taking some of their property, and Verizon is going to say, hold it. Section 253 says you can't do anything to me, state, that impedes my ability to provide CMRS service. So that provision, under the argument of Verizon, is no good anyway. It's a Trojan horse. because you can't take any of Verizon's property to satisfy your tax bill because it would be impeding their ability to provide CMRS service, which is what Section 253 argument of Verizon is all about. So they're wrong.
What about the section that requires security in certain situations?
These are all typical tax provisions. We have seen before...
But wouldn't that tend to set up some barriers on entry?
The barrier is already there in the sales tax. I think counsel said that there's a difference between the sales tax and the tax here because there is an incremental burden because they already need a sales tax license. There's nothing in Section 332 that tells us about this incremental burden business. And indeed, the legislative history of Section 332 tells us something different. And here's what I mean. That was enacted in the 1993 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. And in the legislative history, House Report Number 103-213, page number 486, the conferees say that it is the intent of the conferees to clarify that nothing in this act, the 93 Act where Section 332 was enacted, alters or affects the authority or lack of authority of state and local governments to assess ad valorem property or other taxes on the licensee. The Congress is saying in this conference report, nothing in the 1993 Act where 332 emanates from is intended to alter or affect state taxation. All of these provisions here today are necessary in a logical tax administration system. We need to have a sales tax license. We need to have a gross receipt tax license. Why? We have to keep track of taxpayers. Licensing requirements that we're talking about here have been around for a long time. In 1935, this state enacted a sales tax in Chapter 205. A permit requirement is found in Section 34E of that 1935 law. You have to have a sales tax permit even as far back as 1935. And additionally, back in 1935, the South Dakota legislature saw fit in Section 41 of the same bill to say it's a crime not to have a sales tax permit, it's a crime not to pay your taxes, it's a crime not to file your sales tax return. These are provisions that are carried forward from the sales tax law and found in Chapter 10-33A. These are tax administration provisions.
What about Section 9, though, that doesn't appear to me that the requirement that they have to pay all other taxes has any relation to the gross receipts tax?
Well, Section 9 has an identical counterpart, of course, in the sales tax. And here's the point, Your Honor. If you got a taxpayer that's not paying one tax to the state, why in the world would you give them a license so they can not pay another tax to the state? We need to have hammers against taxpayers, whether we like it or not, to force them to comply and pay the taxes. All of the provisions that we talk about here have been before this court in one shape or another over the years. Responsible corporate officer liability is disliked by Verizon. State versus Thewes was a responsible corporate officer liability case. Records that are required to be kept. In re Rife was a records case. State versus Rutman's had records components to it. Crimes. State versus Rutman, State versus Dorkhout, State versus Karras, State versus Weber. Sometimes you need to have some provisions to induce people to pay taxes. You can't have a tax system where you have no tax administration provisions and expect that the taxpayer is going to voluntarily send a check to the Department of Revenue and Peer, because it just doesn't happen. These are tax administration provisions, all 11 of them, from top to bottom. What did the Congress intend? Did the Congress intend to take away the state's power to tax by taking away valid tax provisions? And the answer is no.
In your research of these cases that involved federal preemption, have you been able to glean any kind of criteria that the court would look at in making a determination on whether this is preempted or not, such as is it overly burdensome or is it pretextual, or is there any kind of criteria that you've come up with that would give the court guidance on how do we determine whether or not it is actually contrary to the federal law?
Well, to begin with, what are the plain and ordinary words of the federal law used. They don't say a thing about tax. Number two, what's the congressional intent? And of course, we divine that from the words used. We also divine it by legislative history on the congressional level and so on and so forth. Did the Congress intend to take away the state's power to tax? And as I said in this House conference report number 103-213, they didn't.
No, and I think that's already admitted that the state can tax. But well, then you go the next step. How do we know whether these provisions are contrary or not? Are there some criteria that you can look at to make that determination?
Well, I think the criteria, and let's go to, and talk about Section 253, for example, because I think the criteria that you can look at and hang your hat on is Section 601. Section 253 was enacted in the 1996 telecommunication law. In that same law, Section 601 was enacted. And Section 601 says that nothing in this act, the 1996 act now, shall be construed to modify, impair, or supersede any state law pertaining to taxation. So I think the touchstone is the state law pertaining to taxation? And clearly all of the 11 challenge provisions here pertain to taxation. The only reason that they are on the books is to assist in the administration and collection of this tax. They are identical provisions that are found in our sales tax. There are identical provisions found in the North Dakota laws. This isn't anything new that South Dakota dreamed up in this particular case to try to capture Verizon. If a cellular telephone company came to South Dakota today, they're going to have to get a sales tax license, and they're going to have to get a telecommunication gross receipt tax license and pay the tax. I don't care who a CMRS provider is in South Dakota. I don't care who has a license to practice law in South Dakota, but they both better pay their taxes. And I have to be able to have some tax provisions that I can use to force that payment if the time comes. I hope it never does, but unfortunately, just looking at the cases before this honorable court, it does.
Do you have to post a bond for sales tax license?
There is a bond requirement in the sales tax license, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah, but isn't that only if you've defaulted or something? Isn't that the way I recall?
Actually, there's a bond requirement upon an application for a sales tax license. There's nothing in the record to tell us how many times people are required to get a bond. Generally speaking, you're only going to need a bond if you've been defaulting on your taxes. So that's not in the record. But
Verizon hasn't been required to pay a bond.
Not that I'm aware of, no, Your Honor.
And there's no enforcement actions going on. Verizon's paid its taxes, so none of these onerous provisions have in a sense been enforced against Verizon except for the licensing requirement.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
I may have misunderstood. I thought that there was a bonding requirement up front in this case.
No, there's a bonding requirement, I believe, in the sales tax law, but there... let's figure this out.
Then I'm confused too, because I thought they had to post a bond to do business in the state, if I understood Mr. Ernst correctly.
Well, let's get the right statute and get the correct answer here. Section 7 says that they have to get to apply for the license. Section 8 says the secretary shall issue the license. Section 9 says that the secretary may also require an applicant to furnish to the state a bond or other adequate security as security for payment of any gross receipts tax that may become due. That is Section 9, and of course the identical sales tax provision is 10-45-26.
So it's at the secretary's option?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
But you're saying in this case it was not requested?
No, it was not, Your Honor. It was not.
And that clearly, if we were to find that provision unconstitutional or preempted, that would then be severable, wouldn't it?
The bond provision, Your Honor?
How much is severable? I guess that just follows the question. How much is severable and how much is not in this case?
Well, my argument, Your Honor, is this. The 11 provisions challenged are all tax administration provisions. I need them all. You may be able to say, well, maybe you can get by with the crime section without it, or maybe you can get by without this provision or that provision. But that, you see, is a legislative policy determination on what provisions that the legislature believe it needs to help support the administration of this tax.
Unless, of course, it's preempted by the federal government.
Right. Well, but the House report clearly says nothing in the 93 law alters or affects the state's ability to tax. And that's got to include the state's ability to use valid tax provisions, provisions pertaining to tax, to assist in the collection of that tax.
You got about 6 minutes left. Do you want to address a little bit the constitutional arguments Mr. Ernst brought up on the title of the bill?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. It's an Article 3, Section 21 argument. No law shall embrace more than one subject, which shall be expressed in the title. So we got a subject and a title thing to talk about. Now we have to presume that House Bill 1104 was constitutional, and we also have to remember that sound policy and legislative convenience dictate that we have a liberal construction to subject and title issues. Now we're imposing an excise tax on gross receipts. And as I've argued before, all of these provisions are part of the same goal to impose this new excise tax on the gross receipts of the wireless telephone companies, wireless telecommunications companies. The test, simply put, is do all these provisions relate directly to the same subject? Do they have a natural connection? That they not be foreign? Now, this court has before stated that you can have multiple provisions that are accomplishing the same goal. Again, whether they're naturally and reasonably connected, will they or may they facilitate the accomplishment of the purpose so stated? The purpose so stated is a new excise tax. When you're creating a new tax statute from scratch, you can't just say, we're going to enact Section 4, there is hereby imposed a gross receipts tax on telecommunications companies, and have nothing else. You need definitional provisions. You need provisions that tell us where the money is supposed to go. You need provisions that are there to administer the tax.
You mean to the Department of Revenue or to go to the counties?
Where the money is to go?
Yeah. What you need to have that provision on actually where it's going to be appropriated?
I believe you have to, anytime you impose a tax, you have to say where the tax is going to go, and I believe that's a constitutional provision.
I guess I don't understand exactly what you mean by to go.
Whenever you impose a tax under our Constitution, I think the object of this tax has to be, and the purpose of the tax has to be stated therein. I want to say Article 11, Section 12, but I'm probably off. Somewhere in one of those constitutional provisions in Article 11, I believe, is where you'll find that.
But isn't there also a provision that requires an appropriations bill to be separate, a special appropriations to be separate?
Well, there's a provision, a different constitutional provision, and that's Article 12, Section 2, I believe, that says that the general appropriations bill must be separate. This is not a general appropriation issue. This is a special appropriation. Now we're talking about Section 6 and probably a few sentences of Section 5, I suppose. The question is whether you could have a special appropriation in a bill that has different things, and the answer is yes. There's not a problem doing that under the case law of this court. The only problem you run into is whether you have a title problem. In this case, I don't have any subject problem at all. All of these relate to the same subject. But moving over here to the title issue is, again, one of notice. Did the title put people on inquiry? And the question is, did that title put people on inquiry that there was that special appropriation in this bill?
Well, didn't Education Association versus Barnett settle the issue that you can't have a special appropriation and a substantive law provision together in one bill?
I think that case stood for the proposition that you can't have, if I can remember the case, you can't have in a general appropriations bill changes to substantive law. This is not a general appropriations bill.
But in light of Article 8, Section 2, which requires special appropriation bills to be separate with single subjects, isn't it inconsistent or impossible to combine the two?
I think if you look closely at Article 12, Section 2, if you look closely at that, it talks about of the same object or something like that. And of course, that's never been raised by Verizon in this case. So the point is, you could come to that conclusion. Now, I think that my title was put everyone on good enough notice, but I think if you come to the conclusion that you needed in this bill a statement that and to have a special appropriation, that you can go ahead and sever the special appropriation and save the rest of the bill. Now, here's the test for severing is two parts. Number one, would the legislature have enacted it? And the first part is whether what's left can stand alone. Now, this bill can stand without a special appropriation shipping money off to the counties. Because here's what's going to happen. The money's going to sit there in the state treasury unappropriated until the legislature comes to town and appropriates it. That's what happens if we sever off that special appropriation. But the next question is, would the legislature have enacted that law? And the answer is yes. Why? For fiscal year 2004, they had a $27,000 surplus. They needed to have their 60% of the telecommunication gross receipt tax in there to balance the budget. So the answer is yes. If it's the choice between balancing the budget and not enacting House Bill 1104, they're going to balance the budget. So the answer is an emphatic yes. They're going to go ahead and say, we need this provision, and severing is not going to be offensive of the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Ernst, do you have 10 minutes, sir?
The state doesn't really argue that the licensing portions of 1033A do not affect entry. I don't think I really heard that argument. The argument I did hear time and again is the state needs them. We need them. I think there are two responses to that. One is there's really nothing in the record to show that the state needs these provisions. This is an appeal from a grant of summary judgment on the state's summary judgment motion. It carried the burden of proof on that motion, and there's nothing in the record to support the argument of counsel that these provisions are absolutely necessary. And again, the North Dakota law we'd submit belies the argument that these provisions are absolutely necessary. Second, I agree with counsel that you have to look at the legislative history to Section 332. We concede that, of course, Congress intended to permit states to tax wireless carriers. But the fundamental part of the legislative history of 332 that counsel doesn't address is that until 1993, when Section 332 was enacted, states could, in fact, regulate entry, and in particular regulate certain aspects of intrastate service. But as wireless service began to develop, Congress recognized that it was an interstate service, it was a competitive service, and Congress wanted to do everything it could to encourage the build-out of the service. So it specifically decided that it didn't want what it referred to as balkanized state-by-state regulation, with each state imposing its own entry requirement. Again, this statute does provide entry regulation, and I just don't think the state ever really addresses that argument head on. It's a very absolute prohibition on entry regulation established by 332. These provisions very clearly on their face constitute that entry regulation. And I'm sorry, just to clarify on the bond issue, I didn't mean to suggest there's an absolute bond requirement, but the Secretary of Revenue does have discretion to require the posting of a bond or other security if he so desires. He did not in the case of Verizon Wireless, but he certainly may. And it is the fact that he has discretion to do it, that he has discretion to promulgate licensing regulations generally. It's the fact that the statute does provide for licensing revocation on certain circumstances that very expressly constitutes entry regulation.
If a wireless company that is licensed by the federal government, in what manner could they be denied by the present laws of the state of South Dakota under that entry requirement?
I don't think they can be denied the right to use the radio waves in South Dakota.
But I mean, if they're licensed under the federal, if they're licensed by the federal government, and then they supply whatever information they have in relation to that, what requirements here can prohibit entry into the state of South Dakota?
The licensing, the licensing requirement says you cannot enter this state unless you get a license. Now, the licensing application may be one page long, but the fact is 332 doesn't set up a flexible standard. It really is an absolute prohibition on entry regulation. So it's not the job of us to sit and evaluate under 332 how significant the burden is.
Well, then are you really suggesting that no matter how ministerial the act, that the state can't impose that as a part of a taxation scheme?
I'm suggesting it cannot impose entry regulation. I wouldn't...
No matter how ministerial the act might be?
I wouldn't characterize these requirements as ministerial. Anytime a licensing scheme is set, criminal sanctions are applied, potential bonding requirements are in place, corporate officers may be held personally civilly liable. I wouldn't regard those as purely ministerial.
No,
but I am.
You were talking about filling out the license. You're objecting to that. You're suggesting that the state can't even require Verizon to fill out a piece of paper to get a license.
Well, no, because we have a federal license, and as we explained in another section of our brief, that license gives Verizon Wireless, other carriers, the right to use the radio waves here in South Dakota. South Dakota can require us to get a tax ID number, to pay the tax, to impose criminal sanctions if carriers don't pay the tax, to impose civil liability if carriers don't impose the tax. There's a broad panoply of things the state can do to compel compliance with the tax.
An issue if, in fact, you were denied entry?
Your Honor, I think it's an issue on the face of the statute, and if you look at the cases, what they do is they look at the face of the state regulation, and if it constitutes entry regulation, then the state has not, then the courts have not hesitated to strike those provisions as being inconsistent with Section 332, or what's really a complementary argument with Section 253, which also, 253 also exhibits Congress's fundamental concern with bringing down barriers to entry.
If I understand you right, you've challenged basically every enforcement mechanism, civil or criminal, except filing a lien. And Mr. Weiss says he can't even, the state couldn't even do that because it'd interfere with apparently your property, which is exclusively focusing on providing the telephone services. He's portraying the Department of Revenue as an usher in church, handing a plate down the pew and hoping somebody puts some money in.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, that's an absolute exaggeration of our argument, and I tried to make perfectly clear that the state could place a lien, could levy against property of wireless carriers. If that ultimately results in the seizure of the carrier's property and ultimately results in the carrier therefore not being able to provide service in the state, then so be it. The state must have an enforcement mechanism. I agree with that. But again, that's fundamentally different from the argument that I heard, which is, you know what, we want to be able to control who enters the state under certain circumstances. And I'm not here to hold a brief for delinquent taxpayers. Verizon's doing business in the state. It's paying the taxes under protest. But that really is fundamentally the argument, that the state should be able to say, wait a minute, we want to have the right to deny entry to certain providers. And that's what the statute, the federal statute, absolutely prohibits. There's really a false, though, conflict being set up by the state between 332 on the one hand and the state's right to tax on the other hand. And by constantly repeating the mantra of it, the state needs these mechanisms, the state is really fueling this false conflict. There can be effective enforcement of taxation without violating the federal statute.
If this scheme was preempted by 332 or 253. Why would Congress in 2000 have passed the Mobile Telecommunications Sourcing Act?
Because in 2000 there was a very real and complicated issue about which jurisdiction could tax certain calls. Was it the jurisdiction from which a call is sent? Was it the jurisdiction from which the call was received? The MTSA is Congress's effort to bring uniformity so that there's not double taxation, and it's very clear which jurisdiction can tax which certain types of services.
But doesn't that highlight Congress's intent to allow state taxation like this?
It may well, but again, I would be the first to concede that states do have the ability to levy taxes, just not those taxes that directly encroach on Section 332. And again, Verizon Wireless has paid taxes in this state for many years without objection, because those taxes don't raise the issue here. And the challenge here, I believe, is a limited one. It's an important one, and it reflects very important federal policies, but it is limited to specifically some of the provisions here. And it's not, Mr. Chief Justice, to continue to answer your early question, our challenge is to the licensing scheme portion of this, to the criminal penalties that attach to a failure to obtain a license, not to the failure to pay tax, just to the failure to obtain a license. It's really the licensing provisions. Now, there happen to be several of them scattered throughout the statute, but I don't want to leave this court letting it think that this is a broad-scale assault on the state's ability to tax. It's simply not. Finally, just to sum up on Article 3, Section 21, again, Section 6, Section 5 were very critical to the legislature. They spoke loud and clear on that issue by their override, and under those circumstances, the court cannot severance. We believe that the grant of summary judgment should be reversed on appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Ernst. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.